Well, what I hope to do is to define the source of the term microlensing to start off with. Where'd that come from? What is it? Show you, you know, why people got excited about it. You know, the probabilities of detecting planets, if a lens has a planet, is pretty high. And then I'll go through the, in sort of a rapid way, the methods of determining the probabilities of detection, okay? And then go into the state of the art, what people are actually doing, you know, what have we found? And there have been some claims of planet detection. Not very many people believe them, but they're there. And then I'll talk about what might happen in the future. Well, first of all, what is microlensing? This is a rather obscure galaxy, a little galaxy here sitting up there. I don't know exactly where it is. But if you look at the galaxy with much higher resolution, this slide was provided to me by Omar Blaise. Now, when Tristan was talking, his slide became utter chaos up here. I told him I was worse, so we'll see what happens. Got a wind here as well. But this is that same galaxy, but this distance across here is about 1.4 arc seconds. If you're looking at the very center of the galaxy, these four images are the same object. They're the a quasar that's imaged by gravitationally lensed by this galaxy. And it's called the Einstein Cross, and John Hooker found it, and been a lot of stuff done on it at the present time. But the interesting thing that we found in a look at these, that these images varied, their light varied in a non-correlated way. And if they're the same object, there'll be time delays between one or the other because there's different path lengths for each one of the images. But they should be correlated if you do this cross-correlation function with the two. But the uncorrelated objects were thought to be separate lensing of each image by stars in the galaxy as they pass through. Okay, and let me show you the information about the cross. These uncorrelated variations in image are interpreted as a variation in gravitational lensing by individual stars as they pass through. They can refocus the light which is already focused, already amplified. Okay? And the term microlensing comes from the fact that the images of the quasar from the individual stellar lenses are separated by microarc seconds. Okay, they're very, very close together. And we will consider, the term microlensing has stuck whenever something is lensed by a star, in spite of the fact that the images are not necessarily separated by microarc seconds. And we will consider such microlensing of stars in the galactic bulge by intervening stars, okay, where the separation image is on an order of milliarc seconds. Things are much closer. Okay? And such lensing events are of interest to planetary scientists because a planet near a stellar lens can perturb the light curve in a non-subtle way and therefore reveal its presence. To illustrate the microlensing, these are the same objects, these are the four images. Up here is an image taken in the G-band, I think that's green. I don't know quite where the G-band is, visible anyway. And these are taken in the infrared. The infrared image is not microlensed. So this is the real relative brightness of those four images. And it's not microlens because these stars, what I'll define later as the Einstein ring radius, is small compared to the region in the quasar region, which is the angular size, which is giving rise to the infrared radiation. And therefore, the conclusion was that infrared was coming from the dust, which is surrounding the quasar region. Here you see these two images are much brighter than they are down here, and both of them are being microlensed by a local star. And these things are flickering all the time. You know, the time scale is like 20 hours or so for these variations. Now, for our case, the geometry is rather simple. The these OLS stand for observer, lens, and source, and the distances with obvious subscripts on the two. Okay. And the only GR you have to know is this scattering angle, this small angle scattering. And with the condition that these two angles, the sum of these two angles equals that angle, you get this equation, which is called the Lenz equation, and defines this Einstein ring radius, R sub b, in terms of these quantities, depending on the various distances and the mass of the lens. And this occurs when R0 goes to zero, or in other words, when the source is directly behind the lens. Okay? And that's a symmetrical image, the so-called Einstein ring, which is imaged by imaging the source in this concentric ring. For a reference, the Einstein ring radius is about 4 astronomical units for a star of a solar mass if it's halfway to a source where the source is at the center of the galaxy. This falls fairly close to Jupiter, is what got people excited about lensing, okay, as we'll see in a minute. Well, as you look on this image from the Earth, okay, from our source here, you'll see the lens and the source. You don't see the lens generally, you do see the source. As the source passes by the lens, this equation has two solutions. So there's two images on opposite sides of the lens from each other. And as the source passes by, these images rotate as it gets closer, they approach the Einstein ring radius, and then as they separate farther away. And this is the amplification. In other words, the sum of the flux that you get from both of those two images exceeds the flux from the source if the lens were not there. And that's the beauty of microlensing. You don't have to resolve the images, but you see a brightening. The stuff gets brighter. And this is the amplification. And these are point sources. And you see a singularity. This U is the separation here normalized by this R sub B. And you see a singularity there, 1 over U. That singularity is removed when you consider the finite size of the source. Okay, so it's not a real singularity. And this is the geometry we'll be considering. We're sitting out here at the sun at 8 kiloparsecs from the center, looking at a source which is probably close to the center of the galaxy, because that's where the stars are densest, and being lensed by a star which is somewhere in between. And generally we don't know what those various distances are. To show that this is not just a theoretical plaything, here's a real light curve. Okay, very densely sampled, much more so than other, because this was taken by the planet group in attempt to find planets. In other words, it's sampled very frequently along the curve, so it's very well defined. But this is a typical light curve, reaching a peak where the things are closest together and then dying down again. From the peak, you know what the impact parameter is, if you can measure the blending fairly well, okay.
What's the ordinate?
Excuse me?
What is the
ordinate? This is time, a trillion days. And this event has a time scale, looks like about 20 days, or a duration. I remember the simple lens equation which we had in the single lens situation, but if you have a planet, it's really a binary lens. Okay, and this is the lens equation, what the lens equation becomes, and what it is a transformation of coordinates from the lens positions, the image position, relative to the source position, relative to some optical axis. Okay. This lambda is, this is in the complex plane, so lambda is c plus I eta is the location of the lens of the source relative to the optical axis, and x plus iy is the angular displacement of the image from the optical axis. And rho is the angular displacement of the planet. Okay, all of these things normalized by R sub b. And epsilon is equal to Q, and Q is the mass ratio, mass of the planet over the mass of the star. The zeros of a fifth-order polynomial developed from this lens equation are the positions of either 3 or 5 valid images. Okay, in other words, fifth-order solution has five. A fifth-order equation has 5 solutions, the zeros. but only three of them are valid in some circumstances, and you have to check each one. Given that the Lenz equation is a transformation of coordinates of an image xy to the coordinates of the source c eta, the amplification of the source by each image is the ratio of the element of an area, okay, at the image position, transformed to the element of area at the source position. And so therefore I can write the total amplification as a sum of the inverse determinants of the Jacobian of the transformation evaluated at each one of those images. So it's all very straightforward. The theory is very, very well founded, very sound. Okay? And the curve defined by in W space by determinant J equals zero, okay, that becomes singular, A becomes formally infinite, okay, those are called the critical curves, okay, where the amplification is formally infinite. This singularity is removed when the finite size of the source is considered. The corresponding closed curves in lambda space, where the source is, are called caustics. And in the case of the single lens, the caustic reduces to a single point right behind the lens, and the critical curve is the Einstein ring radius. Is the Einstein ring. I'll show you examples of these. This is, as you see it from the observer's point of view, with a lens located here and the source moving across this way. The spacing of those has nothing to do with time, okay, just convenience of an angle measurement. Okay. And for each position of the source, we have the corresponding positions of the two images. In the unperturbed case where you had a single lens. Here is the caustic caused by the planet position, okay, and there's a small caustic right here which I've amplified up here. Here's the critical curves, one around surrounding the planet and then a sort of a slightly distorted Einstein ring for the other one. Okay. So as the source moves across the direction, you know, across the plane, across the line of sight as we see it, relative to the lens, okay, these images, of course, move this way, and this one moves this way as it goes across in this direction. And when I get closest to this caustic with the source, this image is closest to the planet. Okay, so that means the planet, as a gravitating object, can start amplifying this image, which is already magnified. And the light curve that one gets in that situation.
What's the difference between the caustic and the critical curve again?
Yes, the critical curve is the place where the image is. The caustic is the place where the, The critical curve is if the source is on the caustic, then the image, one of the images, is on a critical curve. Okay, and, the light curve is pretty astounding. And you see why people got excited about detecting planets with microlensing. That's a big bump, okay, easily picked out by any kind of photometry you want to think of. Okay? And that's the light curve that one gets from the previous image where I put the source by the lens with impact parameter of 20% of the Einstein ring radius. And you can get all kinds of interesting light curves, especially if your trajectories cross the caustic, okay? And these are color-coded, you won't remember those, but here's a series of images that you see. And you see the caustic crossings where the thing zooms way up. It doesn't go to infinity because of the finite size. It'll round off. And from the nature of these caustic crossings, one can determine something about the size of the source, which is being amplified. Okay. But all those are easily detectable perturbations. You get slightly different thing. Well, first of all, notice this when I had, this is for the planet outside the Einstein ring, its projected position on the plane of the sky. And we see generally these curves are designated by first a negative dip, here it is, a negative dip, then a positive spike, and then another negative dip before it comes back to normal. Okay? If I look at a planet which is inside the Einstein ring radius down here, going across, the caustics are quite different. I have three now instead of just two. Okay, there's one here and two up here. And the light curves are characterized by first a positive kick and then a negative dip, where the negative dip generally is the lowest one inside. And to show you that these again are not theoretical playthings, here's an actual light curve of a binary star. Now that's fairly comparable mass now. But here are caustic crossings. Okay? And when it crossed the first caustic crossing, they detected this first crossing. They notified the guys who are looking for planets to take a fairly high time resolution match. Okay? So this is an example where here's a blow-up of that. So you see, they actually match this thing right over the top. And this is the example of the type of photometry that would be necessary in any planet type survey, or trying to find planets with high time resolution, very high highly precise photometry. The nature of this bend over here, expanded out, of course, tells you something about the size of the source. Okay, so the source size goes into the modeling of these systems. Excuse me? This here. I don't know what those are. I don't know. The small ones are probably one sigma errors, I'm guessing, on the photometry.
So how sensitive is the width and amplitude, say on the bottom plot there?
This one?
Yeah, you said that's sensitive to the size of the planet, right?
No, right up here, this curvature.
Right.
See, it's normally go for infinite, but it's a point source.
Right, so can you say how does that change for,
Well, first of all, the bigger the source gets, the lower this peak will be, and the broader it will be. Okay. And so that source size has to go into the modeling of the situation.
I was just wondering how much variation in the size of the source would be within the error bars of the observations.
I don't know what that is. And you get quite interesting critical curves instead of nice circles and nice triangles and so forth for this particular event. These are the caustic crossings. That's what you saw for those various spikes. Okay, and these are the trajectories of the various images which happened during that time. So binary events are very interesting. And this model, I don't know if all those significant figures are justified, but anyway, this is a mass ratio of 0.576, which gave a very good match to the data.
When you mentioned it, how long did it take?
The magnification
in that case?
A few days? Or
the spike you showed was sort of half a minute, wasn't it?
Let's see.
A minute, 2 minutes?
No. Yeah.
These are these are days.
Oh, days.
So this is 1548, so it's an hour or something like hours.
Kind of 2 hours.
Okay,
2 hours. And of course, you must have
I've lost something.
Around the world to
I've lost the.
I don't know whether that's essential or not.
Is this the microphone here?
Right
here. So how does this sound? I'm not sure how this fits in here.
We need a bunch of viewers to figure out.
I think what I'll do is I'll hook it with the hook. There, can't get away. Is that working?
Yes.
Okay. I'm doing better than Tristan did so far. Okay.
Wow.
And you don't get too much information from a microlensing light curve that's detecting the planet. This is the Einstein ring radius. You see it depends on the square root of the mass. Okay. And the duration of an event, how long does it take to traverse the Einstein ring radius, is just given by twice the Einstein ring radius by whatever relative perpendicular velocity that the lens and source may have at the time. Okay. And the duration of an event, you know, of the perturbation, of course, depends on the planet's Einstein ring radius. Remember, we don't get much amplification until you get close to the Einstein ring radius. When the source is on the Einstein ring radius, the amplification is 1.34, and that's typically designed, typically used as an alert. That's the beginning of the event. Okay. And both of these depend on the same variables except for the mass. Okay. So if I take the ratio of the two Einstein ring radiuses, I get a measure of the mass ratio from the ratio of the duration of the events. And one can see that on this figure I had earlier, if I can find it. I had it tagged too. What happened? Here it is. In reality, one does some complex modeling to get this thing precise. But roughly, you can see it's easier to measure the width of this thing compared to the width of this. Okay? And that's the square root of the mass ratio to the first approximation. Next, we can get a measure of the separation of the planet, at least its projected position, okay, as normalized by the Einstein ring radius. Because that follows from the perturbation's place on the light curve. Where is it? Because you know right at the peak, you're right at the closest approach point, and you know from the amplification what that separation is. So it's easy to do the geometry to find out where, how far away the planet is relative to the lens. Okay? And that's about it from the light curve alone. Okay. Now, if you get more information, for example, the lensing star can be seen. Sometimes that's a plus and sometimes a minus because it increases the blending of the light. But if you can take that out, if it can be seen, then its mass can be estimated spectroscopically. Okay? And therefore yielding the planet mass, M, from the known mass ratio, from the ratio of the durations of the events. If the event is sufficiently long, okay, most of the stuff we've done so far, we've assumed the planet and star are fixed, but it's moving in an orbit of some kind. And if the duration of the event is very long, it's going to move a considerable fraction of its orbit during the time of the event. So the geometry changes. That makes the light curve asymmetric, okay? And the Earth's motion, okay, can move, you know, change the aspect of where it's looking during the time of the event. And it's Earth's motion that's usually doing most of the motion, most of the moving, because the planet may be a Jupiter, which is out at 5 or 6 astronomical units, and will move very little during that time. But the Earth moves a lot. So it's the angle of the position makes the light curve asymmetric, and you can estimate a parallax. And this was done for one event that lasted 220 days from the Macho group. And they got a distance to the lens of 1.7 to 2.8 kiloparsecs, depending on the type of the lens star. Okay, the lens star was not seen. That's because most M stars are going to be M stars, the lens stars. So what is the probability of detecting a planetary companion of the lens? Now, one assumes it has a planet. So what are the probabilities of finding it if during some kind of microlensing event? Okay. And you saw the spikes of the various light curves, the various perturbations of the light curve. We can assume the planet will be detected if the fractional perturbation of the light curve exceeds twice over the signal to noise. Okay. That's a 2-sigma type of detection. For at least 20 consecutive data points, where the signal to noise is instantaneous photometric signal to noise ratio. Duration of the perturbations for this mass ratio Q of greater than 10 to the minus 4, for the Sun, that'd be greater than the Uranus mass or so, will almost always ensure that the latter condition can be satisfied. In other words, you're watching it long enough to get these 20 points to really secure the fact that you have a perturbation. So we must determine what the total projected positions of the planet relative to the lens will allow the perturbation to exceed, twice 2 over the signal to noise, sometime during the event, and the probability that the planet will have such a projected position. Now, where is it going to be with some probability? We start this out by saying that to account for the random position of the planet in its orbit and the random inclination of its orbit relative to the plane of the sky, we assume the planet is uniformly distributed over a sphere. Okay? And once that assumption is made, it's easy to determine the probability distribution of the projected position of the planet. Okay? What is the probability it'll be within R and R plus dr relative to the star it is? Okay? And it's a rather simple expression. This is not probability density, but the cumulative probability. The planet, this f sub r, is the probability of finding the planet between r and the semi-major axis of its orbit. Okay, and the probability density is the negative derivative of this. And we deal with this instead of the probability density because we avoid the singularity that would be downstairs if I differentiate this thing. Now, all of the microlensing equations are in terms of ratios of distances. All of them are normalized by the Einstein ring radius. Okay? And so it behooves us to express this expression in terms of the same type of ratio. And this brings the Einstein ring radius out in the open with its dependence on the mass, the distance to the source, and the distance to the lens. Okay, and these distances are also normalized by the Einstein, by the, these distances are normalized by the distance to the center of the galaxy. So these are whatever the distance is divided by 8 kiloparsecs. Okay? By choosing this constant property, I can express A in terms of astronomical units, and the mass in terms of solar masses. Okay. These are the definitions of the quantities. And for fixed zeta and A, in other words, for a fixed source distance and a fixed semi-major axis, this distribution has to be averaged over the mass that are available and over the distance to the lens, because we don't know what those are. In general, if we just see a light curve, we have no idea generally where those stars are. And to do this, I choose a particular bulge model of Zhao and a disk model of Bacall and Sonera.
We have to know the position of the source, too, right? So
in other words, we don't know that either.
Yeah.
And we're not averaging over that yet because we'll see that the probability, since we're using signal to noise, depends on the brightness of the source. And since we don't know a priori what that brightness is going to be, we have to average over the luminosity function. So we have to do that first before we average over the distance to the source.
Relate the luminosity function.
Exactly. Exactly. For signal to noise, the observers will recognize that all that's in there is photon noise. All that's there. And with this mysterious factor of 1/4 that's afterwards, okay? These are the definitions of the various things. The phi star is just the flux density from the source, the photon flux density from the source, number density. And phi sky is the sky surface brightness. Okay? This is the time of the integration. Sigma is the seeing. D is the telescope aperture. When one plugs numbers into this thing, I get unreasonably high values because I've not considered any systematic effects. Nothing else is in here. So since these are for observations from the ground, it behooves us to compare these with real data, real signal to noise. And by doing that, here's comparisons of two. The first by Albro from data taken with a 91 centimeter telescope at Cerro Tololo. Okay. So what I did is I adjusted the value of my Sinclair noise expression such that I match his value at night for a 19th magnitude star. Okay. That's why those two are the same. And fortunately, the other numbers came fairly close to what he got at brighter stars. Okay. To check this, In order to get these two to match, I had to multiply this signal-to-noise expression by the factor of 1/4. Okay. As another check, I found some data from LIC, actually sent to me by Alex Filipenko. This is now a 76 centimeter telescope with a time of integration of 300 seconds, much worse seeing. Okay. With the same factor of 1/4, one matches the data pretty well for the brighter stars, but getting down toward the limit, it doesn't come so close. Okay. So for our purposes here, I adopted the signal-to-noise expression depending on photon noise only with the factor of 1/4. So this is what I will use to determine the signal-to-noise expression. Now remember in the binary lens equation, we had a way of determining the amplification. Okay? So for a given source position relative to the lens, that's right here, one can determine what the amplification is in a grid over this plane, okay, and then just use any contour routine to see what the amplifications are. Okay? These red contours correspond to a perturbation in the light curve, in other words, a single lens light curve, which is 2 over the signal to noise. Okay. Now, and that's a signal of noise corresponding to the instantaneous amplified source brightness. So as the source moves across the screen, these systems rotate, the contours wax and wane depending on what the position is, how close it is to this source, and the instantaneous signal to noise. Signal to noise gets greater here. For this particular plot, the signal to noise, two of the signal noise is 0.094 at this position, okay? But at close approach, two of the signal noise reduced to 0.071. So I get a higher signal to noise when I close this up. Inside these contours, the perturbation is greater. So if the planet is anywhere in this green area, okay, sometime during the event, these contours will sweep over it and give a perturbation which exceeds 2 over the signal to noise. And the probability of detecting the planet is then simply the probability of finding the planet in this area, contained by the green curves. Okay? Now let me show you a slight qualification of that. That was for an impact parameter of 0.04. If I make the thing really close, these things balloon up. And the interesting thing about this graph is that these contours go all the way around the Einstein ring radius, okay, all the way around the Einstein ring, inside of which the detection of the planet, you'd see this perturbation greater than 2 over the signal to noise. That means that regardless of what the angle of the trajectory is relative to the star-planet line, the probability of detecting the planet if it falls in this region is 1. You're certain to detect it. Okay? So if you don't see it in these high magnification events, then it's not there and you can exclude it. Okay? You also notice that the contours overlap the trace of their extremes, which means by just taking the area inside these extremes, you'll be slightly underestimating the total probability. But this is only important for the very small impact parameters. We're going to average over those impact parameters in any case, so this can be no more than about 1% effect on the probability you calculate. The bright sources give higher signal to noise, and therefore increase the area. This is for the red curves are for a 19th magnitude star, and the green for a 21st magnitude star. And you see the increase of area means you have higher probability of detecting the planet, the bright sources. And the efficiency, or the probability is a function of the impact parameter is given in this plot, zooms way up when you have very small impact parameters because you have this huge area. The probability of finding the planet in this area, which covers almost the whole plane, you know, where in the region where the Einstein ring radius is important, is almost unity. So you're certain to detect the planet if you have the very small impact parameters. No way. The average detection probability based on the signal to noise criteria will depend on a lot of things. The planet star mass ratio, density over M star, the mass function, because we had to average over that, the luminosity function of the source star, because that determines your signal to noise. The extinction along the line of sight, because that determines how bright the source is going to be. The galactic model, the distribution of stars along the line of sight, and the distribution considered as lenses, and that same distribution considered as sources. The distribution of observed impact parameters, we saw the probability varied, and it's going to depend on the same major axis of the planetary orbit. The average probability, since the lens distance and mass of the lens are unknown, we must average over the cumulative probability distribution of the projected planet position over the mass function and over the lens distance weighted by the distribution of stars along the line of sight to the source. Okay. The probability distribution is then integrated over the area swept out by those contours, in other words, the area between the green curves. With this 2 over S over M minimum perturbation for each of the distribution of impact parameters as a function of the source I magnitude. Okay. Resulting probability must then be averaged over the source luminosity, because we don't know what that is a priori, okay, adjusted for each source distance and extinction. And finally, the resulting probabilities must be averaged over the source distance weighted by the distribution of sources along the line of sight. And that's represented by this grand average down here, and these are the models which I used to do those averaging. Result is large probability. This is the probability of detecting a planet during a microlensing event as a function of its semi-major axis, averaged over all of those quantities. Okay, and you see it's substantial for a wide range of semi-major axes. And it peaks here. Why does it peak near this point? If you remember the contours which I drew about the amplification, and I said that if the planet was inside that, the amplification would be greater than that limit of 2 over S over N. The perturbation would be greater than the limit of 2 over S over N. As you approach the Einstein ring radius, the perturbation gets bigger and bigger. So the maximum perturbation will occur if a planet is close to the Einstein ring radius during the event. Okay? So what this maximum then reflects is the averaged Einstein ring radius. In other words, the semi-major axis equal to the averaged Einstein ring radius, which occurs about 1.5 to 2 solar astronomical units. 1.5 to 2 astronomical units. Because why is it so small? Because we're dominated by M stars. And most of the stars in the mass distribution are M stars, and therefore low mass, and therefore have low Einstein ring radii.
This includes an average over the possible orientations of the semi-major axis?
Yes. So that was done right at the beginning, when we assumed it was uniformly distributed over a sphere.
Is this the probability just relative between the different radii, or is this the probability of something that they're trying to infer?
This is for a particular lensing event, assuming that it has a planet. Okay. For example, a planet, for example, at 4 astronomical units. Okay. I forgot to point out, there's the two plots here are for two different impact parameter distributions. This is with uniformly distributed impact parameter, which is what actually occurs. But you're observationally biased to the small impact parameters because you get higher magnification, more likely to see them. So if I use an empirical value of the actual real distribution of impact parameters, then I get a much higher probability. Because remember, if I had small impact parameters, I got a higher probability of detection. Okay. And this probability is not a general probability of finding a planet if I look at a particular microlensing lens. It's the probability, if it has a planet, of this particular properties and of that mass ratio. Okay. Now, to see if this thing has any viability, we should see how it varies within the model to see if it's at least consistent. And the first thing we can do is to change the line of sight. Okay. So these are the probabilities only, this is for the observational efficiency determined impact parameters. And I go from this initial value towards Botta's window of galactic longitude of 1 degree and latitude minus 4 degrees. And as I go out, I keep moving the line of sight farther and farther down in latitude. Okay. What's happening here is I move the line of sight, I'm changing the effective mean Einstein ring radius. Because as I move it away from the bulge, I have fewer and fewer sources at the region where they're densest, okay, near the bulge. And the Einstein ring radius gets small as I move the lens closer and closer to the source and move it towards this bulge. So I would expect then that if I increase the mean Einstein ring radius, that means it's less likely for a close planet to be close to the Einstein ring radius. Its probability detection is going to decrease. Okay? At the same time, those which are farther away, their probability is going to increase. So that's consistent with that particular change. Suppose I change the mass function. Instead of having the mass function turn over to a minus 1 index for the M stars, the lowest stars, that's continued on up at minus 2.2, right up through the whole length for the whole mass distribution. This is what the Holtzman et al. Mass distribution gives you, minus 1. This seems to be necessary to account for the time frequency distribution of the events toward the center of the galaxy. No more M stars than are actually observed. Okay? And as you expect, we're reducing the mean Einstein ring radius by putting more M stars in there. And as a result, the peak changes, goes over to lower values, and the probability decreases for the large semi-major axis and increases for the small semi-major axis. So that's a self-consistency. How does the probability vary with the lens mass or the mass ratio? This is the one we calculated before. If I reduce that by a factor of 10, it drops down to this point. It goes approximately as the square root of the mass ratio. Okay. In other words, this is a factor of 10, so this is almost a factor of 3. Although it's not perfect. It's like a factor of 5 here, a factor of 3 here, and a factor of 2.8 here. So it's not perfect, but it's a rough approximation. In real events, I have an estimate of what the source magnitude is. And from the peak amplification, I have an estimate of what the impact parameter is. This says for real events, we should not necessarily average over luminosity functions because we know what that source magnitude is. And we shouldn't average over the impact parameter because we know what that is too. And here is with those averages eliminated, and you see exactly again how the probability changes as a function of the impact parameter. Now, how does one find these perturbations? The ratio of these timescales gives the ratio of the square root of mass, which is generally very much less than 1. The average time, the average duration for 58 events during the 1997 bowl season was about 49 days. Okay? That means the with this mass ratio of 0.01, I get a time of the event or the perturbation of about 1.5 days. If I have an Earth mass type planet, the perturbation only lasts a couple of hours. So I have, if I want to pick up the Earth mass or even these, we must therefore monitor the light curves continuously at least once per hour with a 1% photometry to catch the perturbations for Earth mass planets. Okay? And after detection, every few minutes to get a sufficiently accurately perturbed light curve for an ambiguous interpretation. And unfortunately, that's hard to do. Because here is the probable fraction of a sidereal day that one can view the galactic center where all your sources are going to be. If I have a system of telescopes scattered around the world in, at southern longitudes, okay, this includes the fact that takes into account the seeing and the number of usable nights at each telescope. Okay? And if I average this thing, I only get about 50% of the time which I'm able to look at the center of the galaxy, even excluding this time when the sun gets directly in the way. And that's because you never have the whole night, except when the thing's overhead at midnight. So you have less and less over the, at the best time, you have less and less fraction of the light observable. But in spite of this, there have been claims of planet detections. Okay, this is from a paper by Rhee et al. This event stands out because it's the highest amplification of any event that's been observed, an amplification of almost 80. Thing. And remember the high probability we were seeing for high amplification events, okay, when you got those things. And this is the generally two light curves. Let me show you. The black curve is a model through these points, assuming that there's a planet in the system. Okay? You just barely see this faint blue line. That's the unperturbed light curve, and you see this little peak. Unfortunately, the main part of the peak occurs after the data stops. And the problem was this thing was setting as they were taking data. And that's why the air bars get so big right at the end. So the claim for a planet detection is based on noisy data. And therefore, not many people believe it. And here's the actual ratio of the light curves. This is the planet, this is the model. And you see how many points you have. You have a few. And for that, with that few points, the Rhee et al. People claim a detection. That's a fairly small planet. The mass ratio is only 7 times 10 to the minus 5, like Uranus or so. What is more secure, remember that region of unit probability of seeing. If the planet is in that region, it's to be seen for sure. So this graph has more credibility. This is an exclusion region. It says for masses up here, for these separations, if it's black, it's 100% certain that the planet's not there. Okay? Then as you decrease the mass, you become less certain. But this is a secure plot because of the unit probability of capture, pretty high probability for those big events. There's the high amplification events. There's been another claim by the same group of a planet. This is a very complex light curve. It's a binary system, have it. And these guys claim a 3 Jupiter mass planet at 7 AU, okay, to account for these perturbations here. These two plots, the dark curve is the one with the planet. The dotted curve is the one to account for these things by relative motion of the binary system during the event. In other words, just two stars, but moving during the event to keep these things. The claim by Rhee et al. Is, in fact, that the thing would have to be moving higher than the escape velocity in order for these curves to be true, so they choose the planet. At the same time, the planet is this is their scheme, this is their data, their interpretation. Two planetary detections are very much controversial and not accepted by people.
But apparently they also match the data from the other two.
And they're arguing back and forth.
So
no one has agreed that they're right or wrong. That the location was right. Okay, you monitor a bunch of planets, you don't see any planets. What can you say about their appearance? So this is the state of the art of observing people. And this comes from the procedures follow. You get a high precision, high time resolution photometric data with a single lens model, just like we showed before, by minimizing the R squared with these things as three parameters. This is the time of the peak amplification. This is the time scale of the event, how long it last. This is the minimum approach, the impact parameter. F0 is the unperturbed flux from the star, and F0 is the ratio of the flux, which is from unresolved stars, which is also getting into your photometer. Ratio of that flux to F0. So one minimizes chi-square to determine this the best fit curve. Now, one assumes a planet of a particular mass ratio and a particular separation in terms of Einstein mean radius. The projected source trajectory through the binary system at some angle alpha relative to the lens planet line. And you do the same procedure again. You again minimize chi squared with the same set of three parameters. You repeat the process for a uniform distribution of alpha. Okay, to follow it around. And the curves, in like curves, which have delta chi-squared, the chi-squared being your binary model, minus the single-end model, greater than some threshold. Threshold is due to be a subjective choice, would indicate that a planet would have been detected if it were there. Okay. So the detection efficiency, the probability detection of this XQ planet, is just equal to the fraction of the curves, the trajectories, which delta chi squared exceeds that threshold. This theta is a step function. So we get 1 when it's positive and 0 when it's not. We argue it's positive. And this is an example of the trajectory. Now, if some of those trajectories, X and P planet, yield a delta chi squared with the opposite sign, that's sufficiently less than the chi squared of the point source point lens function, chi squared, then one can claim detected.
Well, microphone.
Has I lost it again?
I lost the video. How did I lose the clip? Must be a better way. Now I'm going to show you an exclusion plot in a minute from the planet group which have analyzed, they followed about 43 events very carefully with very high precision, high time resolution photometry. Okay, this epsilon XPQ was the same thing I showed you previously. You know how that's calculated. So there's probability of detecting a planet of mass Q at X of P is equal to R over R sub B during the event if the planet is there. Okay. If in reality the fraction of stars in the data set which have a planet with those parameters is this F, okay? And the real probability is reduced to the factor of F times epsilon, okay? The probability of not finding a planet is just 1 minus this quantity, okay? And since the events are independent, the probability of not finding an XPQ planet during any of the events, okay, is just the product of those probabilities of not finding them, guess one. Okay? Remember, this is determined for each event. And this is a model-independent number. It depends only on the data. Okay? So the probability of detecting an XPQ planet is 1 minus this thing. Okay? So if you don't find any, and the probability of finding them is this, is P, okay, then we can say that the fraction of stars that have such planets, if you, in other words, if I choose a value of FXP, we can say that the fraction of stars that have such planets is less than this fraction, F of XPQ, at confidence P. Okay? Once the grid of probabilities of versus XPQ is established for all of the events, one can choose a confidence P and a fraction F and find the array of XP and Q that satisfies those constraints. And hence the plot which I'm about to show you. This is real data. It's the latest result of microlensing detection of planets. And all we get is an exclusion. Okay? And these correspond to various fractions. One up here is 1/4. And they chose a 95% confidence level. Okay, so this says there are no planets around those stars, or less than 1/4 of the planets around of the stars in the data set will fall into this region. In other words, their mass is above about 0.01, with this range of separations, depending which D is this normalized by the Einstein ring radius. Okay? And so as the number of events which are monitored like this increases, okay, and you still don't find anything, it's going to widen and depth and deepen all of these curves. So get more and more confident that there are not planets there. Now the advantages of a microlensing search for planets is that we can be promised a large number of events. Okay, there have been about more than 600 found so far. Microlensing is particularly effective in detecting Jupiter and Saturn mass planets at distances from their stars where they're likely to have formed, in other words, several astronomical units out. Okay? Remember, there's sort of a lensing zone that surrounds the Einstein ring radius. And so they're very effective in finding these massive planets. This is in contrast to radio velocity and astrometric techniques, which need the planets, both of them need a very long time scale, and radio velocity ones are in fact more sensitive to the very close planets. The statistics on the occurrence of Jupiters at their proper separation would start accumulating immediately, okay, in a dedicated program. And the procedure is robust, so no result would be meaningful, as I showed you just a minute ago. Okay? The disadvantages, there can be no follow-ups. You see it once and that's it. You'll never see that event again, you'll never see the planet again. Okay? And from the light curve alone, all we get is the planet-star mass ratio and the projected separation. Okay? But in spite of that, it's still useful for collecting statistics. Okay? So what happens in the future? The current rate of monitoring galactic microlensing events for planetary perturbations is too low to gather definitive statistics for planet occurrence during the next decade. In other words, we've only got 43 events over 6 years that have been monitored carefully. And you see that how you're biased against doing this thing from the ground because of the limited time you can actually look and watch. So even a massive effort with 4 or 5 dedicated 2-meter class telescopes distributed in longitude still suffers from the limited coverage of most events and the limited number of events that could be monitored simultaneously. In other words, if I have 100 events going on at the same time, okay, that I am monitoring, in order to get high time resolution, there's a limited time I can spend on each event. If I reduce the time I can expend on each event, I decrease the signal to noise, and therefore my system gets noisier. So you can't arbitrarily increase the number of events that you monitor. There is an alternative proposal that unfortunately one of Dave's missions beat out in the latest discovery competition.
Well, but your competition might have been...
Was Kepler. Answer. Was Kepler, yes.
Kepler.
Yes, that's right. And GEST is a Galactic Exoplanet Survey Telescope. It's a space-based telescope that will serve both as a survey and follow-up while continuously monitoring 100 million stars in the galactic bulge. This thing had a huge CCD array with a wide-angle field to get that kind of coverage. The 10 to the 8 stars will be continuously watched with better than 0.3% photometry for 3 8-month periods with a time resolution of 1 minute. So you're doing everything at once with 100 million stars. With that kind of coverage, you could even find up to 100 Earth mass planets if they happen to be in the lensing zones of every star you're looking at. Okay? So you probably wouldn't see any. But that's how the mission was sold, and that's probably maybe why it died. I don't know. On the other hand, there are potentially thousands of massive distant planets, Jupiters and Saturns, that we detected through the microlensing perturbations. Okay? And more certain, not microlensing, because that photometer sitting up there, would be the detection of about 50,000 giant planets in transit if the frequency of close Jupiters found locally persists throughout the galaxy. Okay? And if you're watching 100 million stars simultaneously, you'd catch everything with this 0.3% photometry. So that's the state of the art of the microlensing search for planets. Thanks.
Questions, I guess.
Date and schedule. Isn't part of the problem that these one piece fits is that they're not unique?
You
don't have complete coverage.
There are degeneracies in the variables.
Okay.
That's true. And I could show examples of ambiguities in the measurement, but if you have a high enough resolution photometry, you can resolve most of the ambiguities that you have. In other words, you can get good data if you have high enough precision photometry. This stuff that would be done from the satellite would do it. You would find out a lot of information. In particular, if they aren't there, you know, because the probabilities are robust, and so if they aren't there, it says something, you know, about it. You know, it means really they're not there. You can put some confidence in that statement.
Okay. So now we'll hear about transits. Team Brown.
Maybe we have to assemble this thing again.
Can I just ask a simple question? What day we expect in the future?
Excuse me? I think unless we get something like a satellite telescope in space, I don't think much. It's too hard. And for this group, I'm not sure the data, you know, all you're getting is statistics essentially. You're getting the number of planets per star or whatever, certain astronomical systems. The fact you only measure a mass ratio is not as bad as it sounds. If you have a large number of events, the stellar mass is only very over an order of magnitude, or so, whereas the planetary mass is very over 3 orders of magnitude. So the actual mass ratio you measure is a pretty good measure of the actual masses of the planets. If you have a lot of planets. So the problem with this, just having statistics, it doesn't tell you anything about the properties of the planets.
Right.
Unlike transits, you know, close transits, then you get a density, a size, which are the relevant things most of the time, and meaningful as far as construction of the interiors. But I'm not sure if knowing the numbers. Knowing the numbers is important for such things as terrestrial planet finder, looking for terrestrial planets.
Where to look.
Because if it turns out that
very, very few stars have Jupiter where they belong. Then it looks pretty grim for terrestrial planets. That means probably both of them migrate and cleaned out the terrestrial planet itself. Mm-hmm. And so from that point of view, you gain, in other words, if I had a microlensing search and I found that one in a million stars had a Jupiter where it belongs, I wouldn't spend money on the terrestrial planet.
Right.
It is, of course, useful to know about systems that have planets, even when you can't see the planet, in order to find candidates,
right,
which you then use a better map,
right, right,
to look at the planet.
Right.
So that's why the radio velocity star, even though it's only demographics, so to speak, to begin with,
yeah,
can be the stepping stone to something else.
Right.